What job did Yaakov Avinu give to Yosef HaTzadik? He told him to go check on his brothers who were shepherding the sheep in Shechem. Yosef responded, Hineni, here I am, I'm ready, I'm going to go do it. What bothered Rashi about Yosef's response of Hineni? Rashi was troubled that it seems to be a little bit reckless. You know, Yosef HaTzadik knows that the brothers hate him. And here he goes, he's going alone, unarmed, right, to check on them. Seems a little bit reckless. And so Rashi explains that Yosef HaTzadik was displaying three virtues, three good midos, when he answered that Hineni. Number one, he was displaying humility, right? Maybe in his own judgment, there was something dangerous about this, but if Yaakov Avinu tells him, please do it, Yaakov Avinu feels that it's a good idea, so then it must be a good idea, even if his own instincts perhaps tell him otherwise. Number two, this Kibbud Av V'Aim. His father is telling him to do something, and maybe for Kibbud Av V'Aim, can take a little bit more of a risk than you would take if you were just, you know, trying to do something for yourself, doing something for a parent. Maybe, you know, put yourself out, be a little bit less, you know, comfortable, a little bit, you know, in order to do something for a parent. You wouldn't do it for yourself, but for a parent, you got to go, you know, out on a limb. And finally, it was Zrizos. The third one was Zrizos, which means doing something quickly, not delaying, not tarrying. Says right away, I'm ready to do it. Earlier, we discussed the Aruch Chaim, who said that Yosef was constantly trying to make it up with his brothers, to decrease their hatred, you know, for him. And, you know, when he shared his dreams, he was showing them trust. I'm sharing something personal with you, but I trust you that you're not going to use it against me. And so over here also, Yosef HaTzadik might have been showing his trust in the brothers. I'm going to go alone. I'm not going to take any, you know, weapons with me or anything to protect myself. You know, that way, hopefully you'll see that I'm not out to get you, but that I trust you and that I love you and I want you to love me back. And we talked about how Yosef HaTzadik's Hineni was similar to Gedalia's actions prior to Gedalia's assassination. In both cases, these were people who did not take steps to protect themselves, even though they knew that they possibly were in danger. Gedalia also, before he was assassinated, he got reports that, you know, Yishmael ben Netanyahu was trying to assassinate him. But he said, Lashon Hara Lamed, hey, I don't believe it. And he didn't, you know, wear a bulletproof vest, and he didn't walk around with bodyguards. And eventually he was blamed for his own assassination. He should have taken more precautions. And so Yosef HaTzadik perhaps should have taken more precautions as well. On the other hand, you know, we talked about some differences between Yosef's situation and that of Gedalia. In Gedalia, there was, you know, it wasn't his brothers. You know, it wasn't, you know, under the close supervision of Yaakov Avinu. The political, you know, landscape, the family landscape was very, very different. And so perhaps, you know, even though Gedalia was faulted for failing to take precautions, but Yosef HaTzadik perhaps could not be faulted. Then we began to talk about the Malach that met Yosef on the road. And, you know, we started off by talking about the ideas of Pshat and of Medrash. You know, Pshat basically means the basic, you know, plot, the basic, you know, storyline. You can tell the story about Yosef HaTzadik finding the brothers very, very briefly, right? Yaakov sent him to find the brothers, and then he found them, and they threw him into a pit, right, etc. And all of the extra details, when you read something carefully and you take, you know, you notice the details, right? Perhaps there's words there that you know, are not necessary, that seem to be not necessary at first glance. Maybe there's words that are missing that ought to have been there, and maybe we use a strange word instead of, you know, a more normal word, you know, and questions along those lines, you know, that's Medrash, reading carefully. Pshat is a basic storyline. This happened, and then that happened, and the other thing happened. The Medrash is reading carefully and paying attention to the details and seeing, you know, how the details add to the story. You know, we gave a mashal that when you're, you know, when you're drawing a cartoon, so, you know, you can make a stick figure cartoon, which has very, very little, you know, detail, just, you know, stick figures and, you know, thought bubbles and speech bubbles. But a person who's an expert, you know, artist is going to add things to the cartoon. He's going to add color. He's going to add depth. He's going to, you know, group characters in a certain way and group the frames in a certain way. And that really makes, you know, the message of the cartoon much, much stronger and much more enjoyable. And so the Medrash is sort of like those extra things beyond just, you know, the stick figures and the speech balloons, which give, you know, the added detail and depth and meaning to the Psukim of Chumash. So that brings us to the discussion about the angel that met Yosef. And in Tanakh, there are two meanings of the word Ish. The first meaning is that Ish means a man. The second meaning is that Ish means an angel. In Sefer Daniel, Daniel sees angels all the time, and he describes them as Ha'ish so-and-so, Ha'ish so-and-so. The Rambam, in the second parak of Hilchos Yesodei HaTorah, writes that there are 10 different levels of angels, Eifanim, Chayes HaKodesh, Srafim, etc. The lowest of those levels are called the Ishim, and you know they're called the Ishim, the Ishes, right, because they're closest in level to humans, and so they're called the Ishes. And in our story, there is a machlokes about what the word Ish means. The Ibn Ezra says that the word Ish in our story means a man, which is what it usually means in Tanakh. But Rashi says that the word Ish in our story means an angel, the same way that it means an angel in Sefer Daniel. Again, in the words of the Pasuk, you know, who found Yosef at Tzaddik when he was lost in the field? It was an Ish. According to the Ibn Ezra, it was a man. According to Rashi, it was an angel. The question becomes, you know, so why does Rashi seem to want the Ish to mean angel? Why can't he say that it means man like it usually does? And to answer this question, we need the Medrash. We need Mefarshim, commentaries, who read very, very carefully the Psukim and notice details that would be lost to us on our first reading. And so we actually, you know, looked at a number of different Mefarshim who read the Pasuk very carefully and found many details that, you know, don't seem to make so much sense if that Ish was a man, but make a lot of sense if the Ish was an angel. So let's just go through a couple of those questions. Question number one. It says that a man found him and he was lost in the field. And the question is, why does it say the man found him? Usually, if you're lost, you know, you look for somebody to ask directions to. If you're driving and you get lost, it's not as if a passerby, you know, is going to knock on your door, when you know, on your car window when you're at a red light and say, excuse me, but can I give you directions to where you're going? Usually you roll down the window and say, hey, can you tell me how to get to this highway? It's very unusual for the passerby to stop you and say, hey, can I give you directions? I mean, here the pasuk says that the man found Yosef. It doesn't say that Yosef found the man. But it makes a lot of sense if that man was an angel that Hashem sent to find Yosef and give him directions. It says, "Vayishaleu aish lemor matavakesh." The man asked him, "What are you looking for?" And again, you know, how did the man know that Yosef was looking for somebody to begin with? You know, a regular person would not be expected to know that Yosef was, you know, was looking for someone. But if it's an angel, it makes a lot of sense that the angel, you know, the angels have knowledge and insight that regular humans don't have. And so the angel would have known that Yosef was looking for somebody. Yosef answers the angel. He says, "Vayomer es achai anochi mevakesh." I'm looking for my brothers. How does Yosef know that the angel knows who his brothers are? Right? Hagida nali efohim urim. Can you tell me where my brothers are? Well, we can maybe give you a description of what your brothers look like. Say how many there are. Give him some sort of no. Yosef is not telling him who the brothers are. He says, yeah, of course, you know my brothers. Why does Yosef assume that the angel knows that this Ish knows his brothers? It makes a lot of sense if the Ish is an angel. Again, angels know things that people don't know. Again, Yosef says, please tell me, where are they shepherding? Why does he assume that the Ish knows where his brothers are shepherding? Like, would any stranger know where the brothers are shepherding? Like, do you know where they're shepherding would have been a more appropriate question. But again, if the Ish is an angel, it makes perfect sense. The angels know things. And that's why Yosef assumes that he can just say, yeah, tell me where the brothers are. Some other points, you know, that the Mefarshim raise. The word Ish appears too many times in the pasuk. It says Vayimtzaeu Ish v'hineto ebasadeh v'yishaleu ha'ish leimor matevakesh. You know, the repetition of that word Ish is unnecessary. It could have said a man found him and he was wandering the field and he asked him, you know, what are you looking for? Why does it say And the man asked him, that word man, you know, ish, the second ish is redundant. It might be telling you that, you know, that you should look a little bit more carefully into the identity of this ish. And if the ish is stressed, it means that there's more significance to it than just a random, you know, passerby. And finally, we talked about, you know, the whole detail. He got lost, and then somebody directed him, and then he found. Why is this even important for the story? Why is this important for the Torah to tell us? Just tell us. Yaakov sent Yosef. He went to look for his brothers, and he found them in Dothan. Why is it important to know that he went to Shechem, and he was lost in the field, and then an ish found him, and they had a whole dialogue? What's the point over here? There must be some sort of a lesson, and that lesson, which we'll discuss in just a second, it fits a lot better if you assume that that the ish was an angel. So what exactly is the lesson? So the Ramban here has a famous line where he says it's to teach us ki ha-gzeira emes v'ha-charitzos sheker, which means that when HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a plan for a person, for a family, for a community, and it's pointless to struggle against that plan. The proper way to use your energy is not to struggle against it, but to figure out how to make the best of it. And eventually, if people figure out how to make the best of it, they'll end up in a better place than if they struggled against it. I told the story in class that once I had a student, and he didn't get to the high school where he wanted to go. His parents, forced him to go to the school where I was teaching, and he was very, very resentful. He spent the first 2 years, 9th and 10th grade, struggling against it, doing everything that he could to try to get himself kicked out, or to get his parents to regret their decision to send him there. It was really a waste of time. He tried, to get, never over a 70, right, on an exam. He didn't want to fail, but he didn't either want to do well, because he was hoping, right, that his parents, would switch, schools for him. He, made a lot of trouble, not, enough trouble to get himself kicked out, but enough trouble, right, to send the message to his parents, I want you to switch me someplace else. And then, he grew up a little bit more when he got to 11th grade and 12th grade. And, I think he was a little bit regretful. He had wasted a lot of time in, 9th and 10th grade, where he could have been enjoying himself. He could have been participating in clubs. He could have been doing sports. He could have been, focusing more on his learning and learning more. And instead, he spent all of this time in a fight, against this. It's kind of a waste. And so the point over here of this ish finding Yosef is that, when HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a plan for somebody, whether it's a plan that they go to a certain school or a certain camp, or to get a certain job or to not get a certain job, or to encounter a certain, circumstance, to be in an uncomfortable situation, whether it's a physically uncomfortable situation, right, maybe health problems or family problems or parnasa problems, or a spiritually uncomfortable situation that they find themselves in a place, where perhaps, there's music playing that distracts them from their learning or from their meditation, right? Or they find themselves in a place, right, where they have to, close their eyes all the time. And, so they could say, it's so annoying, it's so frustrating, and then they can stew, right, in their frustration. Right? Or they could say, look, Hashem put me in this situation, there's no way to get out of it, so I'm going to do the best, to rise to the challenge and do my best given the circumstances. And the Ramban says that's the idea over here, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to test the Shvatim by seeing what they would do when Yosef HaTzadik came to them alone and unarmed. And then Yosef got lost. And, it looked like, maybe the test, the challenge for the Shvatim wouldn't come about. But Hashem said, no, this is the destiny of the Shvatim. This is what needs to happen. And so he sent the Malach, to make sure that it happens. And so again, if there had been struggle over there, it would have been wasted. Hashem would have sent more Malachim and more Malachim, because when Hashem has in mind that a person should follow a certain path, so he's going to make sure that they end up, following that path. The charitzos, the struggle against the destiny that Hashem has in mind for a person, is sheker. It's useless. It's a waste of effort. Again, it's hard to know nowadays what exactly Hashem has in mind. Very often there's uncertainty, in which case, you might still be, worthwhile, to sort of try to direct yourself in a certain direction. But once it becomes clear to you, that Hashem wants you to be in a certain place, in a certain situation, at that point, the struggle to get out of it is worthless. You just have to make the best, of the situation. We told the story about Rabbi Mendel Kaplan, that helped us, understand this. Rabbi Mendel Kaplan was a very popular Rebbe, in Yeshiva Torah Vadas back in the 1930s. His wife was the founder of the first, Beis Yaakov, school for girls, Jewish, girls' school in America. And the Rabbi Kaplan would spend, night times collecting money so that his wife's school, could stay financially afloat, that they could continue to remain open. And at a certain point, just collecting at night was not enough. The school was in danger of closing from lack of funds. And Rabbi and Rabbitson Kaplan went to their Rabbi, to Rabbi Aaron Cutler, and said, what should we do? And Rabbi Cutler told him that he should quit his job and he should become a full-time tzedakah collector. Now, becoming a full-time tzedakah collector is not a very rewarding job. It involves, a lot of, receiving a lot of insults and a lot of disappointments. It got to the point that one time Rabbi Kaplan came to the lobby, right, of his wife's school to deliver some money that he had collected. And, the girls, didn't realize who he was. And, they came over and said, "I'm sorry, but you can't collect money," right, in the lobby of Beis Yaakov. Again, it's a job that involves a lot of, people, tend to not care so much about the feelings of tzedakah collectors, which is not the right thing to do. People should be more caring. But again, as soon as his rabbi told him, "This is what Hashem wants you to do," at that point, he didn't, stew in his frustration and say, "Oh, I wish it wasn't so," and try to maybe work it out that I can still do something else. No, he said, "If this is what Hashem wants me to do, this is what Hashem wants me to do." There was no struggle there. There was no charitzos. And that's a lesson that the Ramban derives from the story of Yosef HaTzadik. Where was Yosef HaTzadik when his father sent him to check on his brothers? His pasuk says he was in Emek Chevron. We pointed out that there's an interesting it sets a mood, an Emek, a valley, right? It's a place where one where you can't really see very far. From the top of a mountain, you can see far away, and an Emek is a valley, and your vision when you're in the valley is obscured by the mountains. You can't really see very far at all, and so that kind of fits with the whole theme of the story. There's a lot of short-sightedness that's going on in the story on the part of all the people, not realizing what the consequences will be of their actions. And so the Torah is telling us where Yosef HaTzadik was when Yaakov Avinu sent him away. It actually fits very beautifully with the mood and the theme, of the story. It's this theme of short-sightedness and just not being able to, to see the consequences down the line. Where were the Shvatim supposed to be when Yosef HaTzadik went to check on them? They were supposed to be in Shechem, but where were they when Yosef HaTzadik actually found them? They were in Dothan. So Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky explains why the Shvatim were not in Shechem, where they were supposed to be. And he says that we know from earlier on in the Torah that Shechem was a place where a lot of anti-Semites, lived nearby to there. And the Shvatim, they knew that something was coming. They were already had like an inkling in their mind that they were going to beat Yosef HaTzadik up or harm him in some other way. And they understood, again, they were wrong, for hurting him to begin with. But in their minds, again, we'll see later on, they thought that Yosef was trying to, to murder them, and they thought they were hurting him or harming him in self-defense. But again, they understood that even when you're hurting another Jew in self-defense, you don't do it in a way that makes a chilul Hashem. You don't do it in a place where the mainstream media, can see it and have bad articles about it. You don't do it in a place where lots of anti-Semites, will gloat, when they see Jews beating each other up. Even if you have to hurt somebody in self-defense, it's better to do it someplace in private. You don't want to air your dirty laundry, where everybody else can see it, right? Again, even if there's, discord, in a family and siblings are fighting, right? But you don't want to do it in a way that, that makes everybody think, that the family is dirt. You keep it to yourselves. When Jews are fighting, they keep it to themselves. That's the lesson there of Yaakov Kamenetsky, gets. We told a story about the Baba Varav, how when he first came to America, he did a favor for a certain judge in the United States court system. And the judge wanted to show gratitude. He said, "Rabbi, what can I do for you?" And the rabbi said to him, he said, "If two Jews ever come to you for a court case and they're suing, one of them is suing the other one, tell them that they shouldn't be suing each other in secular court, the non-Jewish, court system. They should go to a Beis Din." Many, many years later, the son and the son-in-law of this rabbi were having a fight about who should be the next, rabbi, the successor, of the Baba Varav, and one of them took the other one to a secular court, and they actually came to this judge. And when they walked into the courtroom, he saw them, he knew who they were, and he said, "I have a message to you from your father, from your father-in-law. Take this to a Jewish court, take this to a Beis Din. You don't air your dirty laundry in front of the whole world. If you're having some sort of a fight, keep it, keep it as private as possible." And so that's what Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky gets over here. They're not going to beat up Yosef HaTzadik in Shechem, where all the anti-Semites are nearby. They went someplace more secluded to Dothan in order to minimize the Chilul Hashem that would come about because of it. What three words does the pasuk describe? What the Shvatim did before Yosef HaTzadik got close to them? The words are Vayisnaklu Oso Laham Yiso. The Targum translates these words as meaning that they conspired to kill him. But the Sefarno translate these words differently. The Sefarno says it means they thought he was conspiring to kill them. In other words, they thought that he was coming to murder them, and that they needed to defend themselves. And all of the actions that they take subsequently, according to the Sefarno, were actions that were taken in self-defense. The Sefarno brings three proofs for this idea that the Shvatim thought that they were acting in self-defense. He says, number one is that the Shvatim are considered to be tzaddikim later in the Torah. They never forfeited their status of tzaddikim. When Hashem tells, you know, Moshe Rabbeinu to make the Mishkan, he says, put the names of each of the Shvatim onto the stones in the Kohen Gadol's Choshen. If the Shvatim had committed such a serious sin as, you know, attempting to murder their brother in cold blood, attempting to sell him, you know, in cold blood for no reason, so there's no way that the Torah would have considered them to be such, you know, such great tzaddikim still after they had done such a thing. And so the fact that, you know, that the Torah considers them tzaddikim means that at least in their minds, they thought that they were justified, they thought they were killing in self-defense, that the sin would have been not thinking about it more logically, not realizing that Yosef was not a threat to them. But it wasn't the actual, you know, act of attempted murder and kidnapping, because that, you know, they felt they were doing in self-defense. It was just that they were not, you know, thinking logically. They should have realized that there was no need to do this. The second proof that he brings is that later on, when the Shvatim go to Egypt and they're thrown into prison and they're doing some cheshbon nefesh, they're soul searching. What have we done wrong that could have caused Hashem to punish us by throwing us into this prison pit? And the Shvatim are like trying to rack their brains. What have we done in our lives, you know, that could have, you know, brought this punishment on us? And finally, you know, one of them comes and says, "You know something?" He says, "You know, we when we threw Yosef into the pit and he was begging us, you know, to have mercy, and it's like we threw him into the pit and we didn't feel bad enough about it." And it's just strange, as the Sefarno says. The sin was that they didn't feel bad enough about it. The sin was that they threw him into the pit. So it seems that even, you know, even when, you know, they themselves are in a pit, they don't realize that throwing Yosef in the pit was actually a sin. And that doesn't make any sense. If there was some cold-blooded attempt at murder and kidnapping, so then you would expect that they would realize it, like, "Hey, you know, we tried to murder our brother. That's why this is happening to us." So it seems that they never really saw this as an attempt to murder their brother. They saw this as self-defense. And the only, you know, chisar and the only, you know, sin that they could find is that even when you're defending yourself, but if you have to hurt somebody, you should feel a little bit bad about it. You should hurt them with compassion rather than hurt them with cruelty. You know, so they, you know, they didn't think it was a sin to throw him in the pit, but, you know, they felt that they perhaps should have said, "We're sorry that we have to do this." They didn't say that was the only sin they could come up with. And the third proof that the Sefarno has is that right after they, you know, right after they throw him in the pit, they sit right back down to their meal, right? And again, you know, the sociopath perhaps could do that. The Shvatim were obviously not sociopaths; they were normal people. And the normal person, if he murders in cold blood, can't just sit right back down to his meal. He's going to have a guilty conscience. It's going to be some sort of troubling, you know, trouble of his conscience. And, you know, the only way that a normal person can sit back down to a meal after they commit a murder is if it's a murder in self-defense, because in that case, it's like, you know, there's no guilt there. It was either me or them, right? They were coming to kill me, so I defended myself. And since that's the only situation that could have possibly resulted in the Shvatim just like sitting down and finishing their meal, like he says, obviously they understood that what they were doing was killing in self-defense.